Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. That's our regular daily broadcast time. Our listeners on one of our stations, the one in Las Vegas, only get to hear us, I think, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays on the radio. Although you should be aware that you can hear the program, the live broadcast, on Monday and Friday as well, because it can be heard from our internet site, and we're only on a few radio stations. So I forget, 6, 7 radio stations, something like that. And they're on the West Coast only. They're in California, Oregon, and Las Vegas, Nevada. But we get calls from all over the country because of our radio broadcast stream to the internet. And so those of you who catch us on KKVV in Las Vegas on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays should be alerted that at the same time you can catch the program live from the website on Mondays and Fridays as well. We have one line open right now. The format of the program, if you're not familiar, is for you to call in with any questions you might have about the Bible or Christianity or differences of opinion, either from the host or from Christians in general. If you're not a Christian and you don't believe in Christianity or the Bible and you'd like to talk about that, I'd be glad to discuss that with you. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Josh, calling from Salem, Oregon. Josh, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing?
All right. Good to hear from you.
Hey, I had a question for you regarding, I guess, morals or ethics on I have a machine shop here in Salem and make different parts for different industries. And I have an opportunity to make parts for an assault rifle for the military and police. And
yes,
I'm not sure what I think of that. It's a really good opportunity business-wise, but I don't know if it's a good thing to be doing as a Christian or not.
Well, obviously, if you have a conviction against all war or against law enforcement, then you could not do that without some compromise. If on the other hand, most Christians, even pacifist Christians, believe that there is a place for law enforcement and that there's even a place for war, although there's a question as to whether Christians are called to participate in war or not. That would be the question. There'd be two questions in my mind ethically about war. One would be, is a Christian supposed to participate in war? And the other is any given war a just war or an unjust war? Now, if you participate in making weapons and they're purchased by the military, they're likely to be used by Christians and non-Christians, and they're probably going to be used in any war, just or unjust. On the other hand, it's not really your responsibility how they are used. If there is a legitimate possible use of the weapon in your thinking, you know, in other words, if there would be some circumstances in which soldiers or policemen would be justified in using deadly force and using this weapon, then for you to make it for them would not be any violation. And now if they turned around and used it for unethical reasons, that would not be your problem. And I would liken it to when Jesus said to pay tribute to Caesar. Well, we know very well that Caesar used some of the tribute money for lawful purposes, you know, maintaining the roads and keeping a police force and doing good things. But he also used some of that government money for bad things. And yet Jesus did not indicate that when you pay your tribute to Caesar, that you thereby become responsible for the bad things Caesar does with it. If there is a legitimate use of tax money and you pay your taxes and then the government turns around and does nasty things or bad things with that money, that's not your responsibility. You paid your taxes because there is a legitimate use of it. Now, when it comes to war, of course, Christians have different convictions. Some feel that there shouldn't be any war at all. There's not quite as many who feel there should be no law enforcement. But if you feel, if I were in your position, I'd tell you what my feelings would be. My feelings would be there are some situations where law enforcement and war are warranted and can be conducted in a moral fashion.
That's what I believe.
Yeah, and therefore the assumption is that you're making weapons for those legitimate purposes. And if somebody takes them and uses them for illegitimate purposes, I don't think it's your fault. Now, if there is no legitimate purpose for weapons, then you making them would be a clear compromise of your Christianity.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I see the good side of it is if they're used effectively, even as a deterrent, and never had to shoot someone, but the cop's carrying a weapon, and he can protect innocent people. I mean, I see it as a good and moral thing, not just a negative. But
right. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong in itself with it. I mean, some Christians would disagree with that, of course, because there's a whole spectrum of belief on that subject by Christians. But since I do believe that some forms of physical force by the law enforcement agencies and even by soldiers in some circumstances is legitimate and moral, I would not have a problem in my conscience necessarily making the weapons, but or parts for the weapons. But, you know, I'm not in a position to decide, but you'd have to work with your own conscience on that.
Yeah, I just, you know, I wasn't raised to believe that war was particularly wrong. And
yeah.
I was raised as a Christian, but, I mean, my parents didn't love war or anything, but you know, when I listened to you teach on war, I think in McMinnville one time, and, you know, opened my eyes to all kinds of different perspectives, and it really had an impact on me. And, I mean, it was, you know, so different than what I heard before. So, and, you know, I'm still digesting that, and, you know, like, I don't know personally whether it would be right for me to be in a war. I'm old enough to where I probably won't ever be required to be, but.
Yeah.
But, like, my brother just joined the Marine Corps, who's a lot younger than I am, and I tried to talk him out of it for a lot of reasons, but one of was just the idea that he may have to kill someone to defend his own life, and he would never possibly be in that situation if he didn't make the choice to go in the military.
Mm-hmm.
But, anyway.
Well, it's,
there's a lot of questions in my mind, having not been, you know, taught world view or Christian view of against war, I guess you'd say.
Well, Josh, you may have read it in the past. I don't know if you've read it recently. You know, I have that article at our website about the Christian's use of forcible resistance, and I don't know if you've ever read it. I know you've heard me speak on it, but it might help for you to read that over again, because I do cover, I think, all the ethical considerations, if I'm not mistaken, on that.
Yeah, I may have a long time ago, but I think that'd be good, yeah, to read again. So you said it's on your site?
It's at our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you'd click on the link that says topical articles.
Okay.
These are articles that were published in a magazine some time ago, and I mean years ago. And there's only a few of them there. Maybe I think there might be only about seven of them, and one of them has a title like something like The Christian's Use of Forcible Resistance, and it discusses the ethics of that.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay, Josh, and if your conscience, you know, sees clear to go ahead and get that contract, then I wish you well, and I'm glad to see it prosper.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Josh, God bless you.
All right, you too.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Jose, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Jose, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Oh, hi, Steve. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
I appreciate, last time I talked to you, I appreciated what you had to say after I hung up as far as preterism or any other thing that, you know, wasn't necessarily something that you had to make up your mind about right away, because that, it is real easy to get caught up in, well, it happened to me, as you had stated that it happened to you before, you know, having, feeling like you have to know these things right away. And
well, people expect you to have a label on you. You know, they want to know how to categorize you.
Yes.
And so you almost feel pressured to make up your mind. You know, am I a partial preterist? If so, what part? And or a full preterist or a futurist? I mean, what am I? Well, if you're not sure, then I would say don't let anyone pressure you into wearing a label until you know what you believe.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a label.
Yeah. Well, not only the outside pressure maybe, but even from myself, you know, thinking that this is an essential thing to know, you know, to be knowledgeable of the truth. Anyway, I appreciate that, but this is still having to do with the same topic. I've heard, I can't remember what series it was that you talked about, where you see Matthew kind of collecting different topical,
arranging the teachings of Jesus in a topical manner, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so where would you, or do you divide the Olivet Discourse from AD 70 to the future?
I divide it at verse 35, I think it is. Let me take a look there real quick here. Matthew 24, verse 35, where Jesus said, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." Now, the reason I see that as the pivot is that just before that, in verse 34, he says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things are fulfilled." Now, all these things seems to refer to the things he's just been cataloging in the earlier verses,
okay,
which would be verses 4 through 33. So he said that all those things are going to happen before that generation passes away, and that's what I would see as relevant to AD 70. But then in verse 35, he says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." And he says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." So this sounds like something, I mean, he's just mentioned the day, he's mentioned that the heavens and the earth will pass away, although his words will not. But with reference to the time when the heavens and the earth pass away, he says no one knows that day or that hour. Only the Father knows. Now, of course, lots of people feel that even beyond this point, Jesus is still speaking about 70 AD. It seems to me, it would seem to me rather strange that something that near in the future would be spoken of as if its date is so concealed and cryptic. Even Jesus isn't allowed to know, or the angels. It's like a big, big secret, you know, when that's going to be. An event like that, which Jesus said is going to happen within that generation, and which did happen 40 years later, you know, he did know the year. What's the big secret of the day and the hour of the same event that God won't even let the angels or Jesus know what it is? I really believe that this day and the hour that no one knows is an event that is far beyond 70 AD, and which is the day that he alludes to in verse 35, when heaven and earth will pass away. So I myself have seen that as the dividing point. And you'll find that after verse 35, you're going to find that the material in Matthew 24 is much more parallel to Luke 17 than to Luke 21. I don't know if you've heard me talk about that, but Luke 17 and Luke 21 have different discourses, and they're kind of merged into one in Matthew 24.
Well, I have, and that was part B of my question, because
mm-hmm.
I think you believe that Luke 17 has to do with the second coming still future.
That is my present belief, yes.
Okay. All right, well then how do we reconcile the fact that previous to verse 35 in Matthew, we have at least three events that are cataloged in Luke 17. Because if you say that previous to verse 35 is AD 70, then we have parallel events in Luke 17. And actually, there's about five events that three of them prior to verse 35, and two things that happen in verses 37 through 41 of Matthew.
Right, right. Now, which ones are the ones before verse 35 that you're referring to?
Before verse 35 would be
mm-hmm.
In Luke 17, verse 31, on that day, let no one who's on the housetop.
Okay.
Verses.
Okay, that's not so much. That's not a description of an event as instructions of what to do. He's telling them to flee. Right.
Where the body is, the vultures will be gathered, verse 37.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Verses 23 and 24, for just as lightning when it flashes, let's see. Yeah.
Do we have that? Does Luke 17 mention the lightning? Where is that? Let me see. Oh, yeah, verse 24, right.
So there's at least three events there that seem to be the, speaking of the same thing. Because I can't figure out why, if it's something that is future,
mm-hmm.
Why he would be telling them flee from Jerusalem the same way, don't go back up to housetop, leave the city.
If it's talking about the end of the world.
Yes.
Yeah, well, those are good objections. And I actually had somebody raise those three points at our Bible forum it's been a few years ago now, and I wrote answers to those. And I mentioned at that time, those are very good objections. I myself do not find it impossible to see my way around them, though some people might not accept my explanations. When Jesus said in Matthew 24:27, "For as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be," I do believe that that is talking about the second coming of Christ yet future. But I think it's mentioned here as an aside because he's saying that before 70 AD, there will be people claiming to be the Messiah or claiming that the Messiah has come. And he says, no, don't believe that, because when I do come, it'll be like the light flashing from the east to the west. You know, it's like the sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Lightning, I think, is a poor translation there. I think it should be translated the bright shining.
Mm-hmm.
As the bright shining shines from the east to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Certainly, the destruction of Jerusalem was not like that, in my opinion, but the second coming, I believe, will be. Now, the fact that he would throw that in there is not surprising or awkward to me. He does certainly borrow that statement from Luke 17, it would appear, or Jesus might have even said it twice. He might have said it even in connection with his talk about 70 AD, but the point here is, he's saying before Jerusalem is destroyed, there will be people claiming that the Messiah has come. Don't go out there, because he hasn't. If you haven't seen him flash across the sky like the whole world will at his second coming, then he hasn't come yet, and whoever claims to be is false. And so I see that, I've always seen that particular statement as not a reference to Jesus coming at that point in the narrative, even if we were futurists and thought that Matthew 24 was talking about a future tribulation, I still wouldn't think that verse 27 is saying that Jesus is going to come at that point between verses 26 and 28, but rather he is mentioning that there will be a coming that will be seen by all. But his context for saying it here, I think, is in the context of his disciples should not be deceived when people think that he has come already. That's not the problem to me. It is the sum. Now, the statement in verse 28, where the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. That is, I take that to be a commonplace proverb, which I think was used in many circumstances. And he used it in, of course, Luke 17, where he talked about one will be taken and the other left, and they answered, "Where, Lord?" And he said in Luke 17:37, "Wherever the body is, the eagles will be gathered together." Jesus also mentioned it in his description of the destruction of Jerusalem, that wherever there's death and decaying bodies, there will be eagles, is what the word, your translation said vultures, but in the Greek it's eagles. Now, that statement about the eagles, it has its origins in Job, where God is speaking to Job and speaks about the eagles. It says, wherever the carcasses are, there her young are, there the eagles are, in other words. And that apparently became, I believe it became like a proverb. To me, it's not very different from saying a proverb like, "Oh, where there's smoke, there's fire," or something like that. You know, we have sayings, and we use them in many different situations where they apply. And I believe that where the carcass is, the eagles will be gathered, is applicable to both AD 70, and I think Jesus said it in connection with AD 70. But I think it also applies to the destruction at the end, which I think he's talking about in Luke 17. Now, that may very well sound artificial to somebody who takes Luke 17 about AD 70. And if it does, then they should have great skepticism about my answers. And it's not any concern of mine whether someone agrees with me or not. I'm only arguing why I hold the views I do. And to me, these arguments have been persuasive up to this point. The part about, you know, whoever's on the housetop, flee and don't go down to get your clothes. I will say that that's a much more difficult statement for me to deal with when it comes in Luke 17. Because, you know, at the end of the world, I'm not really sure where people would be expected to flee to, you know.
Yeah.
Again, I think all things considered, I do believe that Luke 17 is talking about a resurrection, talking about the end of the world, like the days of Noah, and of a selective judgment that would strike some who were in the same bed with someone who, you know, was with them and was not judged. And those things, I don't believe, apply to 70 A.D. And it's just my, you know, I will tell you this, and I've got no problem admitting it. I'm a slow learner. I've said this many times. I'm a very slow learner. I started out as a dispensationalist 40 years ago. I gradually became an amillennialist. After that, I very, very gradually became a partial preterist. And if I'm eventually going to see Luke 17 in a preterist way, it's still ahead of me. I haven't gotten there yet. To me, the evidence has not persuaded me. But if it has persuaded you or somebody else, that's okay with me.
Well, I wanted to get your take on that, because, I mean, it's something that's very difficult to see where the dividing line is. And, you know, I'm going to go back and listen to the podcast and break it down a little bit more, because, you know, you can't assimilate it all in the conversation mm-hmm. over the phone right now. But yeah, I'm definitely interested, because this is something that's just very intriguing to me. And I know that for me, at face value, all these kinds of arguments inclined me at the beginning towards a full preterist view. And I believe I stated before that it was just difficult. There are some things, mainly, you know, the resurrection. I think if that's already happened, it has to be taken in some kind of spiritual sense. Rapture, because I do agree with you that all these things occur at the second coming, the resurrection, judgment, rapture, all these things happen at once. So if it's all been fulfilled, then all these other things had to have been fulfilled also, and that's the difficult part. In what sense did the resurrection happen, if it did? In what sense was
right.
the judgment? So.
Well, Jose, have you ever been over to our Bible forum at our website?
Yeah, I was waiting for it to. I noticed you guys just finally got it up and running, and I did see some discussion there by somebody named Alan. I haven't looked at, you know, a couple
yeah.
of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, there's quite a few partial. I mean, there's quite a few full preterists that contribute to that discussion. And there's quite a few times that I've contributed too. I haven't contributed to the preterist discussion lately because I feel like I've talked about all the points previously and they're in the old posts. You know, if you go to the old posts, you know, from going back and scan through their titles, you eventually find what I've written on that. It also is not, it's never been an interest of mine to convince people that, you know, that they have to believe what I do, but you'll find the whole range of views being discussed there, I think. Except you probably won't find very much dispensationalism there.
Well, that's a good thing. All right, Steve. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jose. Bye-bye. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Brian calling from Portland, Oregon. We have a line open for you also if you would like to be on the program. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. I hope that our discussions don't go over the head of too many people for too long. I realize that people call up and they've got specialized technical words for theological concepts and things, and a lot of times it's just easier to talk to them at that level than to step back and explain every word and every concept to the listeners to whom those things may be new. It's not necessary for you to understand all the technical things. If you are interested in some of the things you hear and don't understand, feel free to call and ask me to clarify something, a word or something someone has used or a concept. However, the discussion on this program can go any direction. And if you have an interest in anything in the Bible, it doesn't have to be technical at all. In fact, it's fine if it's quite simple. Simple questions are welcome, too, and no one looks down on them here. The number to call is 1-800-438-4843. 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Brian from Portland. Brian, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. Yeah, you might go overhead sometime, but we always look forward to learning, so we thank you for sharing with us.
Well, good. You know, we, instead of dumbing things down to people who don't know much, we'd rather draw them in and draw them upward in their literacy of biblical things. So, although we don't want to just kind of talk so much over people's heads, I don't want to anyway, that, you know, they just become discouraged and decide that they can't understand this stuff.
Yep. Well, you do well with it. My question is, and I'll probably hang up here in a minute, and I'm not sure how long I can stay on the line, but I've been trying to share my faith with my coworkers, and one of them brought up Gospel of Judas, and I was unfamiliar with that, and I just kind of want to, it sounds false and like trouble to me. I kind of want to just get a overview, what you know, a little background, and maybe where I could find some more information, but I'm going to hang up and just take your comments over the radio if that's all right.
Okay, Brian, thanks for your call.
Yep.
All right. Well, for one thing, if you have internet access, you can find a lot about the Gospel of Judas there because it made a big splash a few months ago. Was it maybe even a year ago? It seems, I mean, time flies now that I'm this old. It seems like it was just a month or two ago. But I'm sure it was at least 6 or 9 or maybe 12 months ago. I'm not sure. There was a lot of news. Maybe it was even longer. About this discovery of the Gospel of Judas, which made out Judas to be a very close friend of Jesus, closer than the other disciples, and a pretty good guy, and so forth. And this was like supposed to be some great big discovery that really proved a lot. And I just can't see what's relevant. Nobody believes that it's authentic. I mean, even the people who discovered it, the people who promoted it, they don't believe Judas wrote it. I mean, I think the scholars believe that it was written in the 3rd century or something like that, which is long after the death of Judas, like over a century afterward. So I don't really see why the Gospel of Judas would be significant, or the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Peter, or the Gospel of Mary, or these other apocryphal Gospels, as we call them. There were lots of late writings that were claimed to be written by famous early Christians. And these late writings came up in the 2nd and 3rd century and later. And the Gospel of Judas was one of them. And its contents are strictly irrelevant to the historical information about Jesus. The reason that people like to bring them to light is that most of these Gospels were generated from a heretical sect, or not a sect, but a heretical consensus that infected part of the church called Gnosticism. The closest thing to Gnosticism that we would be familiar with is simply the New Age movement today. But Gnosticism was a parasitical philosophy that attached itself to existing religions like Judaism and to Christianity and, you know, corrupted them. You know, it reinterpreted them and made them more mystical and so forth. And all the early Christians recognized Gnosticism as a heresy. The Epistle of John, the First Epistle of John, and probably the Second Epistle of John, seemed to be written primarily with some of these Gnostic ideas in view to refute them. There's some things in what Paul writes in Colossians that sound as if there was some beginnings of Gnosticism beginning to suggest themselves in Asia Minor, and Paul was writing to refute them in Colossians. The early church fathers, who were the early apologists in the 2nd century, were very much aware of Gnosticism and wrote treatises against it, and they were aware of these Gnostic Gospels as well. Now, what non-Christians sometimes are trying to say, although, of course, people can say anything they want to, there's absolutely no reason to believe this, but what they're trying to say is that Gnosticism was the original form of Christianity and that it got stamped out by Constantine in the 4th century. You get this, of course, from the Da Vinci Code and from other sources similar to that that have no authority whatsoever and don't know anything. Dan Brown didn't know very much at all about the subject. He made so many misstatements about it, he embarrassed himself, you know, but he said things like there were hundreds of gospels, or at least 100 gospels floating around in the first few centuries, written by different people, and that Constantine stamped out all of them but four of them, and he kept the four that we have because they made Jesus out to be divine, and that the other gospels made him out to be a mere man. Well, that's, of course, very stupid. Actually, the Gnostics made Jesus out to be more divine than human. The Gnostics actually said sometimes that he didn't even have a body. He was just a divine being that was a phantom and didn't even leave footprints. Whereas the Gospels in our Bible, at least Matthew, Mark, and Luke, make no emphasis on Jesus being God. John's Gospel does, but the three synoptics don't. I mean, if the conspiracy was what Dan Brown thought it was, Constantine should have kept the Gnostic Gospels and thrown out the ones we have. But, of course, Constantine had nothing to do with deciding which Gospels were authentic. Long before Constantine's time, now Constantine was 323 A.D., well, back in 170 A.D., how was that, 150 years before Constantine, one of the leading church fathers, Irenaeus, mentioned the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and said these are the only four Gospels that are universally recognized by the church throughout the world. So Constantine came along way too late to make any decisions about that. Already the church throughout the world recognized Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as the only four authentic Gospels, even though they knew about the Gospel of Thomas, they knew about the Gospel of Peter, they knew about these other Gospels, but they knew they were false. They knew they were written by forgers. And the early church had preserved the original Gospels written by the people who actually knew Jesus, and that's why we have them in our Bible. When people want to say, well, what about the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Judas, I'd ask them, what is it you think that is relevant about them? So some people who were part of a cult 200 years after Christ wrote a fake history of Christ and put Judas's name on it. So why is that helpful? You know, I mean, anyone can write fictions and publish them, and there were plenty of people who did so. If we want to know who Jesus was, we need to be more honest and say, why don't we look at the documents that were written by the people who actually knew him, the people who were really there, the people who lived in the same century with him, and then we might really do some responsible research. But those who want to appeal to these other Gospels, they're really just trying to muddy the waters, and they play on the ignorance of the general public. The general public doesn't have any idea what the basis is of the historical claims of Christianity and the four Gospels that are in our Bible. But it doesn't take very much difficulty to find the information and to find out that, you know, the four Gospels in our Bible are genuine, and the others are all forgeries with fake names on them. And even the scholars who would promote them admit this. But what they suggest is, but even though they are forged, even though Judas didn't write the Gospel of Judas, and Peter didn't write the Gospel of Peter, and Thomas didn't write the Gospel, even so, nonetheless, they reflect a stream or a strand of Christianity that may have been the official true strand. But why then, if it was really true, why would it be that the authors of its books had to lie about who they were? You know, the Gospels in our Bible, the authors didn't lie about who they were. They didn't even mention who they were. All of our four Gospels are written anonymously. In your Bible, it may say the Gospel according to Matthew, Gospel according to Mark, but that's put in there by the, you know, that's their traditional titles. The authors of our four Gospels didn't say that they were Mark or Matthew or Luke or John. They didn't claim to, they didn't have to. Everyone knew who wrote them because the church received them from the hands of the authors. And the church knew who the authors were. But what's interesting is the authors were honest enough they didn't have to claim to be somebody. Whereas those who wrote the Gnostic Gospels did claim to be someone and lied. And even their supporters believe they lied. So, you know, when it comes down to these other Gospels, they are strictly irrelevant to the subject of what we can know about Jesus Christ. There's no danger whatsoever in trusting the four Gospels as we have them as the best authorities on that subject. Appreciate your call. Let's talk to Eric from Salem, Oregon next. Eric, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. I'm calling about, I was wondering if you had any teaching on MP3 regarding mental health.
Well, I have teachings that touch on the subject. Obviously, mental health is not strictly my field of expertise, but there is a series of teachings at our website in the topical teaching section, MP3 files. There's a set called Biblical Counsel for a Change.
Okay.
I think there's 8 lectures, and there's at least, I think there's at least 2 or 3 lectures that compare mental health theories of the psychiatric, you know, community against what the Bible teaches on the same subject. So there is something on that subject there.
Okay. Because the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about it, probably, does it?
Well, not using the term mental health. And the reason for that is because mental health is kind of a misnomer. Health is a term that primarily has to do with physical organisms. Like, you know, if you have a healthy liver or a healthy brain or a healthy heart or healthy lungs, those are physical organs. The mental is not physical. Mental is your mind.
Right.
Your brain can be diseased, but that doesn't necessarily have to affect your mental well-being. It can be. I mean, if you've got a brain tumor, it can definitely change the way your brain perceives things and your mind is affected. But on the other hand, a person can have a perfectly healthy brain, but have mental patterns that are very disordered. And and those mental things, no one has ever proven that mental illness is caused by anything physiological. I mean, there's theories that, in fact, there's the prevailing theories are that there's brain chemistry, you know, imbalances and things like that. And there are in some mental patients, but it's not known whether the behaviors that are being described as mental illness are caused by the brain chemistry irregularities, or whether the brain chemistry irregularities are caused by other choices and actions that the person's doing. I mean, all you can say is there are certain people who are categorized as mentally ill because they have this or that behavior or this or that mental habit or pattern, and it so happens that in some of these cases you find a brain chemistry issue. Well, okay, well, the question is which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is the brain chemistry causing the mental problem, or is the mental problem causing the brain chemistry issue? Because either one is possible. So there's theories only. The Bible doesn't say that there is such a thing as mental illness, but there certainly are descriptions in the Bible of people having problems that we would perhaps today tend to label mental illness, but in the Bible they would be described as being maybe demon-possessed in some cases, many cases. Certainly the people who the Bible describes as demon-possessed would normally have been called mentally ill in our society. And yet I believe that the people that were said to be demon-possessed weren't mentally ill. They were demon-possessed, and they were delivered when demons cast out of them. Also, there's other mental states that are undesirable, like depression and anxiety and, you know, panic and things like that. And, I don't know, paranoia. And the Bible doesn't speak about these in terms that are psychological or pathological, but it describes them as spiritual conditions. The Bible says that the peace of God can keep your heart and mind through Christ Jesus if you are anxious for nothing, and if you in everything by prayer and supplication make your request known to God, that the peace of God will keep your heart and mind. That, well, today they'd give people an anti-anxiety medication, but the Bible indicates there's a spiritual condition there that can be remedied by spiritual remedies. It says in Proverbs, anxiety in the heart of man causes depression. Well, that seems to address things that we talk about as mental issues, but it's not describing them as a mental illness. It says, right, but a good word will cheer up, or something like that. I mean, in other words, there are lots of factors, a lot of them are choices we make, that will affect the well-being and the orderliness of our thinking processes. Now, I do believe, and I think everyone believes, that there are such things as brain injuries or brain chemistry problems. There's thyroid problems and things like that which cause people to be different. People who are hypoglycemic and have other, you know, physiological conditions sometimes act bizarrely and don't even know they're doing it. But those are not mental illnesses. when a person has behavior problems due to a thyroid problem, that's not a psychiatric problem. That's a thyroid problem. That's just a regular medical issue. It's not a mental illness. And when we talk about mental illnesses, we're talking about a very vague category, which, as one famous psychiatrist said, mental illness is just one person's opinion of another person's behavior.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, no, the Bible doesn't use that terminology.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you for your help. Appreciate it.
Okay, all right. God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Curtis, calling from Albany, Oregon. We have a line open for you also, and time for your calls at 1-800-438-5090. If you're interested in either asking a question about the Bible or Christianity, or if you want to disagree with the host, feel free to do that. We're glad to have you do that here. My name is Steve Gregg. You're listening to The Narrow Path. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Curtis from Albany, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, hey, Steve, thanks. I really appreciated Eric's question and your response to that, because I was my call was right along the same line.
Really?
Yeah, you look at the news today and the different pressures that are kind of coming on people, you know, finances and things. And, you know, the Lord warned that the cares of this world could choke out the seed, you know, that's in us. And he also is a warning in the last days, because of wickedness, the love of many would draw cold.
Curtis, I think you got cut off. Are you still there?
Really in love with the Lord, and what are some keys that could help the listeners to really kind of overcome, you know, the stresses and the different things that come upon us?
Okay, Curtis, you need to know your phone has been breaking up terribly the whole call. I've been trying to follow. I think I caught your question, though, but your phone connection may be not good enough to continue at this point.
Okay, I'll listen on the air.
All right, God bless you, Curtis.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, I did miss a lot of that because of the breaking up of the phone, but I think Curtis's question was, what advice can be given to Christians living under pressure, since Jesus said that the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches can choke out the good seed, the Word of God, in a person's life. And, of course, we see it happen all the time. And the Bible does say, you know, in this world you will have tribulation. Now, tribulation, the Greek word tribulation, phlipsis, means pressure. It might even be what we call stress. I mean, except it's stress that's put on us by outward circumstances rather than just an inward experience. But we're in a stressful world, and there are cares of this world, and you know, we can become anxious, we can become angry, we can be, our relationships can become disordered and twisted. All kinds of things can happen to us. We can become depressed. All of these things are really things that people sometimes will end up going to, you know, a mental health professional about. They'll figure, well, I've got depression, I've got anxiety, I've got problems with getting along with my mother or whatever. And frankly, it seems to me that Christians got along without the mental health professionals in these areas for centuries, and so did people who weren't Christians. And I think one of the things that I would advise is for us to rethink entirely the whole foundation for our psychological society's thinking. And that is that it's all about you. It's all about your feelings. And, you know, if you don't feel good, then you should take a pill. You know, if you feel anxious, if you feel depressed, if you feel angry, well, we got pills for all that. You know, we got something to calm you down. We got something to lift you up. We got something to help you sleep. We got something to help you, you know, get along with your mother better or whatever. Or mother, to get along with their kids. Mother's little helper. Mick Jagger sang about back in the 60s. The little pill. The idea that we should be able, with a pill or with a talk, with a therapist, somehow be relieved of difficulties and pressures, including emotional ones. Because it's just not right for me to have to feel this way. It's not right for me to have to feel so sad or so anxious or whatever. It kind of makes it, I think it comes from the baby boomer, I mean, the baby boomers didn't originate it, but I think it flourished among the baby boomers, which, of which I am one, that we've been made to think that the world is about us. You see, our parents were the post-World War II generation. They experienced post-World War II prosperity in America, and a lot of our parents went through the Depression, and, you know, they were determined to give their kids the best, since they were deprived of much in their childhood in the Depression, and after the war, America was so prosperous, it was easy to get well-to-do. And so a whole generation of baby boomers were raised, very much coddled, much spoiled, and came to believe that they should be pretty much the whole universe should cater to their happiness and their satisfaction. And the world just doesn't agree with you about that. I mean, the reality just doesn't agree that that the world's going to conspire to make someone happy. There's trials. Now, when people become Christians, especially in this age with this mentality, they sometimes think that that's what Christianity's supposed to do. Christianity's supposed to make me happy. Christianity's supposed to, you know, give me liberty from unpleasant moods and pressure and stress and things like that. Well, first of all, if your person's coming to Christianity with that in mind, they're probably going to fall away, because they're going to find that Christianity isn't there to coddle you either. Jesus didn't come to coddle you. He didn't come to make you happier in terms of all of your dreams coming true in life. He didn't come to relieve you of all the pressures in life. In fact, he came to introduce some new ones. So, it's that mentality about self, about my feelings, my rights, what I'm entitled to. Those are the fundamental worldview problems in our mentality that have made us appeal so much to psychotherapists and psychiatrists to a certain extent. Now, there's more. Of course, there are people who have really, really strange problems, and in most cases, it's their parents who feel that, you know, the psychiatrist is the almost the savior, because, I mean, they have kids who are just way out of control and plain crazy, and the psychiatrist can give them a drug that makes them behave. In those cases, I mean, I don't want to overgeneralize, because it's crazy to overgeneralize. I'd be as crazy as the people we're describing if I were to overgeneralize. But in cases like that, I think many of them are the cases that we would recognize from a biblical point of view as being demon possession. Most people who have problems they go to counselors about aren't demon possessed. They just aren't managing their moods well. They're not managing their lives well. They're at the center of their life, and the world doesn't agree that they should be at the center. And so they're not at the center of the world's life, and so things don't go for them well. And people snub them, people ignore them, people, they're lonely and they're depressed. I mean, there's all kinds of things that people go to counselors about. But the really severe things, the really wild, violent, nutsy things, those things very probably are demon possession. But in asking if I have any advice for Christians to, you know, hang on to their faith through this kind of turmoil, you know, there's only one piece of advice that has held me through turmoil. I've had lots of turmoil in my life. I mean, as far as external turmoil, and some of it has been internal too. And that is, there's something Jesus said in Revelation 2:10. He said, "Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life." And that's really, to my mind, that's the whole thing. Be faithful unto death. Oh, but what if I'm really depressed? What if Christianity isn't meeting my needs? Well, be faithful unto death. But what if I have anxiety and what if I pray and my prayers aren't answered and I'm, well, be faithful unto death. Christians need to be faithful. Now, you know, there was a time when you didn't even have to be a good Christian to be faithful. People kept their marriage commitments. People, you know, basically, didn't put themselves totally first, and they realized their neighbors had needs too. And it was, most people, even non-Christians, knew, at least good ones, knew that you sometimes have to make sacrifices and suffer for the sake of helping someone else. And that was just the mentality. That's not so much in the mentality of modern people as it used to be. And so it may be that Christians will be the only ones, well, they won't be the only ones, but they may be among the few who will recognize that it's not about me, it's about me following Jesus. It's about Jesus having his way. It's about me being faithful to him. Staying in my marriage isn't about me being sexually satisfied or emotionally satisfied or being treated nicely. Staying in my marriage is about me being faithful. I made a promise, and I'm expected to keep my promise. That's all it really amounts to. And I made a promise to Jesus when I became a Christian. I promised to follow him. I said no turning back. I said that he bought me. He paid for me. I'm bought with a price. I'm not my own. So obviously, if that's true, then there's no excuse for me ever turning away, regardless of what comes along. And when people do turn away, when people do get dissatisfied with God, well, they just show that they weren't loyal. They weren't faithful. They did not pass the test. And that's really what I would suggest. Perhaps I say this a lot because I guess it needs to be said. I don't think enough people realize it. But if you are experiencing, you know, trials or depression or hardship or rejection or anxiety or anything like that, it may be that God will relieve you of that. It may be that prayer will help that to go away eventually. But that's not the main thing that should be your concern. The main thing that should be your concern is, will I remain faithful to God in this situation? That's what the test is. Everything that is a disappointment to us is a test to see if we will turn from God or stick with God. That's why Job went through what he went through. It was a test. Job was being tested, and he happened to pass the test. And that's what we need to do, too. And that doesn't answer all the nuanced questions about what to do if you're depressed, if you're anxious, or whatever. There's plenty in the Bible to help in those areas, and there may be some issues where you need, you know, some special counsel. But for the most part, I don't think the world should need as many mental health professionals as we have and seem to feel like we need today. The world did without them real well before they came along. Let's talk to Gary from Seaside, California. We don't have much time, Gary.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. I got about 40 seconds before the music starts playing. I'm sorry.
Okay. You know, I just I appreciated your answer to this question about psychology and wanted to ask you real quickly if you think that perhaps in some ways psychology has become the religion of the world, that is the deception of the world, that keeps people from actually noticing the fact that the deception is the belief or the lack of belief and the introduction of feelings as the most amplified part of their, you know, it basically amplifies narcissism and puts everybody above law and puts the pill in its place and lets psychologists be your god, you know.
I do think that that people's mentality has shifted from that which is sane to that which is less sane. What is sane is to say we live in a world of hardship. I can't expect and I shouldn't demand that the world is going to treat me well. I should not interpret my assignment here as to avoid pain or to find happiness. But I should find out what my assignment is, see if God has revealed anything about why he made me here, and I should focus on doing that regardless of what it feels like, or how much pain, or even if it kills me. Because my duty, fulfilling of my assignment from God, is more important than feeling good about it. If I'm faithful in this life unto death, I'll have all eternity to feel good about it. I don't have to feel good about it in the meantime. I do, by the way. I enjoy being a Christian. I enjoy following God. But if I didn't, I'd still do it. Because eternity is long and life is short. And that'd be the main thing to keep in mind. We're out of time. I appreciate you calling, Gary, and the rest of you, too. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're listener-supported. If you'd like to help us out, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website, www.thenarrowpath.com.